Disc 3.
Since the agreement's aim was to reduce intra-party squabbling, it seemed only logical that the assignment of senators to committees, and within committees, their elevation to the chairmanship, should no longer be a matter of discussion, but rather should be subject to some arbitrary objective principle. And what principle more objective than simple length of service? The seniority system had thus been introduced in the Senate, and during the intervening decades, the unwritten seniority rule had acquired almost the force of law. With rare exceptions, once a man was on a committee, he stayed on it. The effect of this had been to negate the original aim of establishing the system, which was to increase party discipline and loyalty. Since once a senator was on a committee, he couldn't be removed from it by his party except in the most extraordinary circumstances. In 75 years, only 3 senators were removed. The party lost control of him. So great care was taken in making those initial assignments. The most coveted committee seats went to men whom Aldrich and Allison regarded as safe. Dissidents, as Byrd says, were ruthlessly excluded from influence. Even before the Civil War, some of seniority's implications had become apparent. Since the system made length of incumbency rather than ability the crucial determinant for advancement within a committee, the senators who advanced would in general be senators from safe states, states in which voters routinely re-elected incumbents. The safest of states, of course, were one-party states. And during the decade before Fort Sumter, the South had become more and more one-party, Democratic. So the system had worked to give a disproportionate share of power to that single section of the country. By 1859, a northern senator was complaining that the seniority system had operated to give to senators from slaveholding states the chairmanship of every single committee that controls the public business of this government. There is not one exception. By controlling the Senate philosophers were, of course, not merely exercising the Senate's power, but were enjoying as well the protection of the armor that the Founding Fathers had bolted around that institution with so much care, the armor that insulated the Senate against the power of the people. That armor was as strong as ever. The Coinage Act of 1873 pleased bondholders and bankers, the well-to-do, by making gold the monetary standard, completely eliminating silver as a standard. But farmers and working people, debtors of all types, those who labor under all the hardships of life, in Madison's words, were infuriated by the crime of 73, and this was a majority that in a democracy theoretically exercised political power. In 1874, public feeling did indeed sweep over one wing of the Capitol. The Republicans were removed from power in the House of Representatives for the first time since before the Civil War. But only 1/3 of the Senate was subject to public feeling. There the Republicans remained by far in the majority. The Coinage Act was a major element in plunging the nation into one of the longest depressions in American history, and for the next 250 years there would be debate after debate over easing the gold standard. Occasionally a president would make a move, or the House pass legislation in that direction. Not the Senate. The same pattern prevailed on the tariff. In 1890, the Democratic President Grover Cleveland proposed tariff reform, and the House, with an eye to the imminent November elections, passed it. The Senate didn't. Year after year, all through the Gilded Age, its power kept the tariff in place. That pattern prevailed on other major issues. House procedures gradually became more orderly after the election of Tsar Thomas Reed as Speaker, but senators, particularly those committee chairmen who had held their positions for years, were still the balance wheel of the federal government. A law to authorize federal action against the renewed disenfranchisement of black voters in the South was passed in the House, but blocked in the Senate. So was a law that would have banned violence against strikers by private police forces. The Gilded Age, as Giuseppe says, was not a day for the weak, the unorganized, or the powerless. The legislative pages of that age are sparse indeed if one searches them for laws that would help farmers, labor, minorities, consumers, or the crowded poor in the wretched slums of the great new cities. All during this time, Americans asked their government for help, but, except for scattered moments like the Sherman Act, help was not forthcoming. Congress, summed up one observer, does not solve the problems, the solutions of which is demanded by the life of the nation. And for this the Senate must bear a large part of the blame. To a degree perhaps unequaled in any other period of American history, the Gilded Age was the era in which the Senate was the preeminent force in the government of the United States, the Senate supreme, indeed. And it was during this era that the government was, as the historian John Garrity puts it, singularly divorced from what now seemed the meaningful issues of the day. Divorced to a degree perhaps unequaled in any other period of American history. Between 1874, when Charles Sumner died, and 1900, not a single figure comparable to Clay, Calhoun, or Webster, or to Benton, or to Seward, or to Douglas, or to any of a score of other senators of the Senate's golden age, sat in that tiered semicircle of desks. In creating a Senate for the new nation, its founding fathers had tried to create within the government an institution that would speak for the educated, the well-born, the well-to-do, that would protect the rights of property, that would not function as an embodiment of the people's will, but would rather stand, firmly, as a great bulwark against that will. They had succeeded. During the Gilded Age, the era of its greatest power, the Senate sunk from the heights of public esteem to the depths. Its inertia was a subject of public ridicule. "The Senate does about as much in a week as a set of men in business would do in half an hour," one newspaper correspondent wrote, as was the corruption that infected it. And it was the subject of public anger. Once, Senate and senators had been immortalized in paintings, in a classical, heroic style that became famous. George Healy's glowing Webster replying to Hayne. Peter Rothermel's majestic "The United States Senate, A.D. 1850. Henry F. Darby's "Henry Clay." Rembrandt Peale's "John C. Calhoun." Francis Alexander's "Black Dan" portrait of Webster. Now it was not classicism, but caricature with which the Senate was depicted. It was chronicled in cartoons. Cartoons so savage and telling that they became famous. One of 100 brilliant depictions of the Senate that appeared in the pictorial weekly Puck, founded in 1877, was Joseph Kepler's "The Bosses of the Senate." The cartoon shows the desks of the Senate and the senators sitting at them, men drawn small. Behind the desks, looming menacingly over the little senators, stands a row of huge, pot-bellied, top-hatted, arrogant bosses labeled Copper Trust, Standard Oil Trust, Sugar Trust, Tin Trust. Behind these figures is a sign. This is a Senate of the monopolists, by the monopolists, and for the monopolists. Above, in the gallery, is a people's entrance, barred with a padlock and marked closed. Once, foreign observers had marveled at the Senate as the most remarkable of all the inventions of modern politics. Now their tone had changed. Writing in 1902, the Russian-born, French-educated political scientist Moisei Ostrogorsky would say, "The Senate of the United States no longer has any resemblance to that august assembly which provoked the admiration of the Tocquevilles. It would be no use looking for the foremost men of the nation there. Neither statesmen nor orators are to be found in it. The body is filled with men of mediocre or no political intelligence, some of whom, extremely wealthy, multimillionaires, look on the senatorial dignity as a title for ennobling their well or ill-gotten riches, and with crack wire-pullers and state bosses who find the Senate a convenient base of operations for their intrigues and their designs on the public interest." During the Gilded Age, the Senate's power reached its peak not only in domestic affairs, but in foreign. One-third plus one of the Senate had, of course, been given power to reject treaties by the Constitution. And in 1868, the Senate was given additional power by itself. It revised its standing rules so that treaties could be amended, their text changed, by a simple majority. And throughout three decades, as Schlesinger notes, the Senate exercised its power in this realm with relish, freely rewriting, amending, and rejecting treaties negotiated by the executive. Rejecting was the operative term. Between 1871 and 1898, the Senate did not ratify a single significant treaty. Writing in 1885, Professor Woodrow Wilson said that since a president was forced to deal with the Senate on treaties as a servant conferring with a master, its power was unbalancing the whole system of checks and balances. During this era, senators made policy in another way as well. As had in fact been the case during the entire 19th century, most secretaries of state were former senators. Nor did the Senate confine its foreign policy role to treaties. Together with the House and the Yellow Press, it pushed a cautious president. "I have been through one war," McKinley told a friend. "I have seen the dead piled up, and I do not want to see another," into war with Spain. Only with reluctance was the president finally induced to send the Maine to Havana. After it blew up, McKinley still resisted intervention, but a delegation of senators went to Cuba to make their own investigation, and when upon their return they told on the Senate floor of Spanish brutality and mass starvation in the Reconcentrado camps, the journalistic clamor was suddenly clothed with authority. The Alison Aldrich clique came down for war. 3 days later, McKinley issued an ultimatum to Spain. On April 25, 1898, it was war. War on both sides of the world, as the young nation's cruisers steamed a line into Manila Bay to destroy the fleet of the old. And when the war ended, after just 4 months, and the country suddenly had to confront a great decision, it was among the desks of the Senate that that decision was made. As once, 3/4 of a century before, the Senate had debated the wisdom of building a fort on the shore of the far-off Pacific, now the Senate debated the question of whether America's expansion should stop at that shore, or go beyond it, of whether a young nation which had so quickly become a giant power would confine its power to its own continent, or extend it throughout the world, of whether it would still be merely a nation, or an empire. In December 1898, under a peace treaty hammered out in Paris, Spain relinquished Cuba and ceded to the United States Puerto Rico, Guam, and for a token $20 million, the Philippines, an island archipelago 7,000 miles west of the United States. Subject, of course, to the advice and consent of the American Senate. The debate in the Senate over ratification of the treaty ending the Spanish-American War was a national soul-searching. It was among the Senate desks, 84 of them now, that the imperatives of imperialism confronted other imperatives. Imperatives dramatized because, even as the debate raged, Filipino nationalists rose in rebellion against American troops, and the debate was conducted against a backdrop of atrocities committed by both sides in a brutal guerrilla war that would last 3 years and require the commitment of 70,000 American troops before the independence movement was crushed. Rising for the first time among those desks, 37-year-old Albert Beveridge of Indiana proved that a single speech in the Senate could still catapult a newly elected senator to national fame. "The Philippines are ours forever," Beveridge said. "And just beyond the Philippines are China's illimitable markets. We will not retreat from either. We will not renounce our part in the mission of our race, trustees under God of the civilization of the world. God has marked us as his chosen people, henceforth to lead in the regeneration of the world. He has made us adept in government, that we administer government among savages and senile people." And it was among those desks that 72-year-old George Hoar of Massachusetts rose to reply, in a voice trembling with anger. "I have listened, delighted, as I have, I suppose, all the members of the Senate, to the eloquence of my honorable friend from Indiana. Yet, Mr. President, as I heard his eloquent description of wealth and commerce and trade, I listened in vain for those words which the American people have been wont to take upon their lips in every crisis. The words right, justice, duty, freedom were absent, my friend must permit me to say, from that eloquent speech." Anti-imperialists said governing a foreign country without its consent was a violation of the spirit of the Declaration of Independence. "The United States was trampling on our own great charter in the Philippines," Hoar declared. Henry Cabot Lodge responded that that was not the point, since the Philippines mean a vast future trade and wealth and power. The vote on the treaty was very close. 56 of the 84 votes would be necessary for ratification, and the vote taken in February 1899 was 57-27. That was the vote, a vote in the Senate, that set the stage for the American century. As the 19th century drew to a close, the Senate had been the dominant entity in the American government for perhaps 3/4 of that century. If its glory was gone, its golden age vanished long before, its power seemed as great as ever. But then came the 20th century. Suddenly, with that treaty, the United States was no longer merely a nation, but an empire. an empire with colonies stretching from the Caribbean to the China Sea. The oceans were no longer broad moats that protected and insulated an infant republic and let it grow strong, but lakes over whose surface sped the republic's powerful fleets, lakes on the far side of which were the republic's colonies and coaling stations, sources of its raw materials, markets for its industries, lakes dotted with islands, Puerto Rico, Cuba, Hawaii, the Philippines, Guam, Samoa, other smaller Pacific islands, vital to American interests, in some cases garrisoned by American troops. And with the acquisition of colonies came, all at once, new needs. A navy powerful enough to keep open the sea lanes to the colonies, an isthmian canal so the navy's squadrons could be shifted rapidly between ocean and ocean, protection for the canal's Caribbean approaches. Indeed, the acquisition of colonies created problems beyond the immediately obvious. Had not America brought peace and stability to Cuba? Was it not only logical, then, for economic, strategic, and humanitarian reasons, to bring peace and stability to the entire region, to supervise much of the Caribbean and Central America? And as Americans were to discover in the very first years of the American century, in that revolt or war for independence in the faraway Philippines, conquering a country was easier than governing it. All at once, with American citizens, property, and commercial interests scattered all over the globe, there were decisions to be made, whether or not to send troops to protect them from imminent menace, decisions on how far to go in countering Russian expansion in Manchuria, on how to deal with Santo Domingo's default on debts to European nations, a default that led France and Italy to threaten immediate intervention in the Western Hemisphere. And these were decisions that couldn't wait for Senate deliberations. There were threats and maneuvers that might come when the Senate was not in session and that had to be met immediately. And suddenly, there was a president who was confident that he could make these decisions by himself. Senatorial power had been a coefficient of presidential weakness, and for 30 years presidents had been either inexperienced, like Grant, or indecisive, or simply cowed by the mighty Senate. But with the crack of the assassin's gunshot that struck down McKinley, and to the rage of Senator Mark Hanna, put that damned cowboy Theodore Roosevelt in the White House, the era of weak presidents was over. The executive agreement, the international covenant devised by the president acting alone, had had its origin almost a century before in certain murky phrases in the Constitution. Gradually, in a way that neither historians nor legal scholars have made altogether clear, but largely it appears because in the early 19th century the Senate accepted the device to spare itself the task of considering a multitude of technical agreements, it obtained the color of usage, but almost entirely for minor matters. But when, in 1901, Roosevelt became president, the executive agreement became almost the order of the day. When the Senate moved too slowly for Roosevelt's taste in ratifying a treaty with Santo Domingo to forestall European intervention, Roosevelt, as he himself described it, put the agreement into effect, and I continued its execution for 2 years before the Senate acted, and I would have continued it until the end of my term, if necessary, without any action by Congress. In another executive agreement, one kept so secret that historians would not discover its existence for 2 decades, Roosevelt agreed to Japan's imposition of a military protectorate on Korea. Coupled with the rise of the executive agreement was what Arthur Schlesinger calls a new presidential exuberance about the use of armed force on the pretexts of protecting American citizens and property. Roosevelt, often without congressional permission, dispatched American regiments to Caribbean countries and installed provisional governments. What would have been the result had the Senate resisted TR's expansion of executive authority in foreign affairs cannot be known, because the Senate did not resist. It refused to assert the powers in foreign affairs that the framers had given it. Time after time, when a senator proposed an amendment limiting the new executive authority, denying appropriations for military forces sent to foreign countries without congressional consent, for example, the Senate's GOP rulers saw to it that the amendment was voted down. I say there is no law, and I do not believe there ever was a law, to prevent the Commander-in-Chief of the United States from giving American citizens the protection required by self-respect, Senator Elihu Root declared. A president's authority as Commander-in-Chief, therefore, allowed him to send troops, unless it be for the purpose of making war, which, of course, he cannot do. As the trend toward executive action continued during the Taft administration, protests in the Senate grew louder. But, as Schlesinger summarizes, whatever the nuances of arguments, limitations were evaporating. The executive was becoming habituated to the unconstrained deployment of American forces around the world, and Congress chose not to say him nay. As Roosevelt himself was to say, the biggest matters, such as the Portsmouth Peace, the acquisition of Panama, and sending the fleet around the world, I managed without consultation with anyone. To a considerable extent, T.R. was only telling the truth. Furthermore, precedents had now been established. Following bloodshed in Tampico in 1914, Woodrow Wilson asked congressional sanction to send troops to protect American citizens in Mexico. There was doubt among senators over whether the provocation justified Wilson's reaction, but, trapped by what Hamilton had called the antecedent state of things, they approved the move. No president, and perhaps no outside force of any type, could have so drastically weakened the Senate's power in foreign affairs. The Founding Fathers had given the Senate armor that should have prevented that, but the Senate could weaken itself, and it had done so, stripping away much of its own authority over foreign affairs. But not all of it, as in 1919 Woodrow Wilson discovered. When the President sailed for Europe to personally represent the United States at the peace conference convening in Paris, warships in New York Harbor fired salutes, a huge throng filled Battery Park to cheer him off on his historic journey, and as his liner passed through the Narrows, his fellow passengers saw, all along the Brooklyn and Staten Island shorelines, children waving flags. When the ship pulled into Brest, posters on the walls of the old slate-roofed stone houses called on all Frenchmen to praise this world hero who had come to found a new order on the rights of peoples and to stop forever the return of atrocious war. The American president's idealistic aims had captured the imagination of a war-weary world. In isolated villages in Italy, peasants burned candles before his portrait. All over Europe, crowds cheered him as he paraded through the streets, a reception which, as one historian puts it delicately, tended to increase his sense of mission. And not only was the peace treaty signed at Versailles in May 1919, the remarkably moderate treaty that Wilson wanted, but incorporated within the body of the treaty was a covenant or constitution for a world organization for peace, a League of Nations, which he had determined to bring into being so that the treaty would be definitely a guarantee of peace. And the American people were, by a substantial majority, in favor of the proposed league in principle, and newspapers supported it by a margin of 4-1. But it was not the people of the United States who would determine the fate of the League of Nations, but the Senate of the United States. And the majority leader of the Senate, who commanded from Daniel Webster's desk, was Henry Cabot Lodge. Dr. Lodge, Ph.D., Harvard, historian and author, had been known as the scholar in politics before the advent on the political scene of Dr. Woodrow Wilson, Ph.D., Johns Hopkins, historian and author, who promptly was awarded that title as if Lodge had never held it. The senator loathed the president. "I never expected to hate anyone in politics with the hatred I feel toward Wilson," he had written a friend some years before. He told other friends that the president was shifty, the most sinister figure that ever crossed the country's path. The feeling was reciprocated. The Republican senators, particularly Lodge, were pygmy-minded, narrow, selfish, poor little minds that never get anywhere but run around in a circle and think they are going somewhere, Wilson said. So strained were relations between the two men that at one ceremony Wilson refused to sit on the same platform with the senator. Piled atop the personal considerations were the political. In a wartime truce on politics, Republicans had in many instances supported Wilson's war program more loyally than Democrats. But just before the 1918 congressional elections, Wilson had suddenly appealed to voters to return Democratic majorities to both houses. Furious Republicans considered the appeal a betrayal, and some of them, none more so than Lodge, saw it as a confirmation of what they had long suspected was the president's unbridled lust for power. Lodge believed that Wilson was planning to run for a third term in 1920, and that the president, anxious to be acclaimed as the peacemaker to boost his re-election prospects, was sacrificing the independence of the United States to the League. And when Wilson's appeal backfired, the Republicans took control of both houses, although by a mere 2-vote margin in the Senate, the president's most bitter enemy was elevated not only to the Senate's majority leadership, but to the chairmanship of its Foreign Relations Committee. For Lodge, moreover, the personal and political considerations were reinforced by the philosophical. His 26 years in the Senate had been 26 years of uncompromising advocacy of an assertive, unilateralist foreign policy backed by strong armed forces. He wanted a peace that would strengthen Americans' position relative to the European powers. "The thing to do," he had said during the war, "is to lick Germany and tell her what arrangements we are going to make." Above all, he believed in the sovereignty and independence of the United States. The international cooperation that was the centerpiece of Wilson's League he viewed as a menace to America's need to preserve absolute freedom of action to pursue and protect its own interests. And he believed in the sovereignty and independence of the Senate of the United States. He revered the Senate with a reverence grounded in the same philosophy that had inspired the Founding Fathers to create it. As he was to write in 1921, "It has never been, legally speaking, reorganized. It has been in continuous and organized existence for 132 years. Because 2/3 of the Senate being always in office, there has never been such a thing as the Senate requiring reorganization, as is the case with each newly elected House. There may be no House of Representatives, but merely an unorganized body of members elect. There may be no president duly installed in office. But there is always the organized Senate of the United States." Never, he felt, had the threat to senatorial sovereignty been greater. A series of strong presidents had chipped away at it, aiming at weakening, if not breaking down, the government as nearly as possible to one which consists of the executive and the voters, the simplest and most rudimentary form of human government which history can show, he said. And now Wilson was trying to destroy it entirely. The very symbol and heart of that sovereignty was, to Lodge, the Senate's power over treaties. "War can be declared without the assent of the executive, and peace can be made without the assent of the House," he had once pointed out. "But neither war nor peace can be made without the assent of the Senate." A treaty, he emphasized, is not a treaty just because a president has entered into it. A treaty is still inchoate, a mere project for a treaty, until the consent of the Senate has been given to it. Therefore, he said, "The responsibility of a senator in dealing with any question of peace is as great in his sphere as that of the president in his." Personal malice toward Wilson, political scheming, these were elements in Lodge's motivation. But as James McGregor Burns has written, at the core of the hostility lay genuine differences of outlook and principle. Woodrow Wilson's faith in representative democracy, in majority rule, in the ultimate wisdom of the people, went, as Burns put it, to the very core of his being, as did his belief in the superiority of his mental processes to those of pygmy-minded senators. This feeling was evident in the makeup of the 5-member delegation he selected to accompany him to Paris. While President McKinley had included 3 senators on the 5-member delegation negotiating the treaty ending the Spanish-American War, Wilson took no senators with him. He apparently was resolved to have no opposition in his delegation. His announcement that his chief adviser would be his little-known personal confidant, Colonel Edward M. House, caused distress even on the Democratic side of the Senate. "Who is this Colonel House?" Arizona's Henry Ashurst demanded. "Whence did he come, what has he accomplished, and where is he headed?" Wilson was unmoved. Returning to the United States for necessary bill-signing work in March, he reported that the treaty and the covenant were linked, and then sailed again for France. When Lodge fired a warning shot across his bow, rising at his desk to read to the Senate just before it adjourned at midnight, March 3, 1919, a round robin declaring that the League, in the form now proposed, was unacceptable to the United States, a round robin bearing the signatures of 37 Republican senators and senators-elect. Wilson reacted with contempt. "Anyone who opposes me, I'll crush," he told the French ambassador. "I shall consent to nothing. The Senate must take its medicine." He had outsmarted the Senate, he felt. He boasted to the world that when the treaty was brought back, "the gentlemen on this side will find the covenant not only tied into it, but so many threads on the treaty tied to the covenant that you cannot dissect the covenant from the treaty without destroying the whole vital structure." He assumed, in the words of one historian, that the Senate would not dare kill the peace treaty outright. It would have no choice but to consent. Which showed that the one-time constitutional scholar had forgotten some of his lessons. 37 Republicans, more than the 31 necessary to block a treaty, had already declared this treaty unacceptable. Even if every Democrat voted to ratify it, and several Democrats had their own reservations about it, it would not be ratified so long as the Republicans remained united. And the leader of the Republicans knew how to keep them united. Lodge had, after all, served his apprenticeship under Aldrich and Allison. Now, in 1919, no one knew better than he the various devices and methods by which a treaty could be killed, nor had anyone more practice in the use of them, commented the historian W. Stull Holt. More than a dozen Republicans, led by the rigid isolationists Robert La Follette, William E. Borah, and Hiram Johnson, felt even more strongly about the treaty than did Lodge, so strongly that they were dubbed the Irreconcilables. About a dozen mild reservationists approved the League in principle, but wanted minor alterations. And a middle block of Republicans, strong reservationists, were willing to go along with the League only if American sovereignty was guaranteed. In a series of compromises, Lodge bound the three groups together in a solid front behind a series of 14 reservations, 14 to match Wilson's 14 points. Newspapermen would dub them the Lodge reservations, so that the Treaty of Versailles could be ratified only if these reservations, which would protect America's sovereignty and freedom of action, but which would also have made the League a substantially weaker organization than the one Wilson had envisioned, were added to the treaty. At the height of public enthusiasm for the treaty, Lodge had calmly reassured an ally, "The only people who have votes on the treaty are here in the Senate." And he, not the President, had the votes. Moreover, he had the Senate's inviolable rules under which a proposed treaty had to be considered by the Foreign Relations Committee before it could be considered by the Senate as a whole. And on the committee, he had a solid majority, for its Republican members were either irreconcilables or less ideological skeptics like Warren G. Harding of Ohio. By the time the President of the United States returned from Versailles in his glory, the Senate of the United States was arrayed against him in its might. On July 10, 1919, the day following his return, Woodrow Wilson entered the Senate chamber with a bulky copy of the treaty under his arm and presented it to the Senate in a speech that enunciated the noble ideals behind it. "Dare we reject it and break the heart of the world? We cannot turn back. We can only go forward, with lifted eyes and freshened spirit, to follow the vision. America shall in truth show the way." But hardly had the President finished and left the chamber when Senator Lodge rose at his desk to utter a single quiet sentence that had as much significance as all Wilson's eloquence. He wished to move, the Senator said, to refer the treaty to the Foreign Relations Committee. Woodrow Wilson was now to be reminded of the power of the Senate. The President's eloquence, as Burns puts it, reverberated through press and public, a press and public favorable to the idea of a League of Nations. But Lodge and other opponents of the League believed that if the public was educated to the possible sacrifices of American sovereignty to an international body, public opinion would change. Ample funding from Republican bankers was available to finance this education, a massive public relations campaign, but time was needed for the campaign to accomplish its purpose. And the Founding Fathers had created the Senate to provide such time, to be the cooler for public opinion, to refine and enlarge the public views, and produce the cool and deliberated sense of the community. The proposed treaty was 268 pages long. Lodge began the Foreign Relations Committee hearings by reading the treaty aloud, every page, in a committee room empty except for a single clerk who took down what he said. That took 2 weeks. Then the committee called witnesses, scores of witnesses, to testify against the treaty. And while Lodge was thus playing for time, his allies were flooding the country with anti-League advertising and holding anti-League rallies in major cities, rallies at which the speakers were often senators. The battle was a throwback to the great senatorial debates of the previous century, in which long, closely reasoned Senate speeches had been reported fully in the press and discussed, in town meetings and on street corners across the country. One speech, 2 hours long, delivered in August in a steaming hot chamber by Lodge himself, is all but forgotten today. But whatever the validity of its reasoning, it nonetheless expressed that reasoning with the eloquence and power of that earlier age. You may call me selfish, if you will, conservative or reactionary, or use any other harsh adjective you see fit to apply, but an American I was born, an American I have remained all my life. I can never be anything else but an American, and I must think of the United States first in an arrangement like this. I am thinking of what is best for the world, for if the United States fails, the best hopes of mankind fail with it. I have never had but one allegiance. I cannot divide it now. I have loved but one flag, and I cannot share that devotion and give affection to the mongrel banner invented for a league. For many of the speeches, the galleries were as packed and attentive as they had been for Webster, Clay, and Calhoun. As one historian has written, if Lodge had wondered whether the campaign to convert the American people to his views was working, on the day he spoke, he received ample and gratifying proof from the galleries, which were packed not only with representatives of women's organizations, but with a contingent of Marines who had fought at Chateau Thierry, and who had, in fact, come to the Senate chamber directly from a parade in which they had passed in review before President Wilson. When Lodge finished, mothers and Marines stood and cheered him before the ushers could quiet them down. And there was another reminder of the great triumvirate. Hundreds of thousands of copies of Lodge's speech were printed and distributed across the country. Although Wilson fumed at the slow pace of Lodge's hearings, the president couldn't persuade the senators to speed up. Mustering, in Burns's words, all his presidential and personal influence, he used face-to-face persuasion, talking to senators individually and in small groups, writing private letters to wavering Republicans. But the Founding Fathers, fearing executive power, had armored the Senate against it. The power of the president may have swept across the country, and indeed across part of Capitol Hill. It came to a halt at the door to the Senate chamber. When Wilson summoned Senator James Watson of Indiana to the White House and asked him, "Where am I on this fight?" Watson replied, "Mr. President, you are licked. There is only one way you can take the United States into the League of Nations." "Which way is that?" "Accept it with the Lodge reservations." "Lodge reservations? Never! I'll never consent to any policy with which that impossible name is so prominently identified." The president decided to rally public opinion behind the League by going on a cross-country speaking tour to, he said, appeal to Caesar, the people. But Wilson had evidently forgotten what happened to Caesar, and who did it. Wilson's tour of the country was an epic of eloquence. "I have it in my heart that if we do not do this great thing now, every woman ought to weep because of the child in her arms," he prophesied. "If she has a boy at her breast, she may be sure that when he comes to manhood, this terrible task will have to be done once more." It was an epic of courage and will, as the president fought against mind-numbing headaches that seemed to grow steadily worse, until finally he was struck by a premonitory stroke. And even then he tried to fight against returning to Washington, where, after another stroke, he hovered, paralyzed, and nearly blind for weeks on the edge of death. But eloquence, and the public opinion aroused by it, couldn't make even a dent in the Senate armor. As Burns summarizes, "By crusading for the League, Wilson had indeed nearly thrown his own life away, yet he had not succeeded in changing a single vote in the Senate." Refusing to compromise, the president instructed the Democrats to vote against Lodge's 14 amendments, and they were defeated. But Wilson's proposed treaty was defeated, too. For decades, as Burns puts it, scholars have asked why Wilson allowed the treaty to go down in defeat, why he did not just swallow hard and accept the Lodge reservations as one more necessary concession. Many have speculated that the reason was physical, that Wilson's judgment was clouded, his stubbornness increased by his stroke. But there was a political reason, too, a definitive one in political terms. There was no necessity for the Republican moderates to compromise. 2/3 plus 1 of the Senate was required for passage of a treaty, and Wilson didn't have 2/3. Wilson's last hope, his attempt in 1920 to make the upcoming presidential election a great and solemn referendum on the issue of the League, was snuffed out by the election of Senator Harding, who declared in his inaugural address that, "We seek no part in directing the destinies of the world." The Senate's victory over the Treaty of Versailles proved again that the powers given that body by the Founding Fathers were strong enough to stand against the power of the executive and the power of public opinion, strong enough to stand, if necessary, against both at once. Ultimately, as Burns has written, Wilson's League was not killed by him, by the Senate Democrats who voted as Wilson instructed them, by the Irreconcilables, or even by Lodge. It was thwarted by a political system. Lodge, it is true, manipulated that system brilliantly, but he had only inherited it. In the struggle over the Treaty of Versailles, the American system of checks and balances worked as the Founding Fathers intended that it should. Woodrow Wilson was defeated by a body he considered both unrepresentative and oligarchical. He was right. The Senate was unrepresentative and oligarchical, but it had the power. But what had the Senate done with that power? "If we do not do this great thing now, the terrible task will have to be done once more," Woodrow Wilson had warned. Was his analysis correct? Would another world war have come, as it came only 20 years later, if the Senate of the United States had ratified the Treaty of Versailles and the Covenant of Nations? No one can be certain of the answer. Even if the United States had joined the League, would the country, with an isolationist spirit still heavy on the land, have been willing, when called upon, to meet its obligations? Would the other great powers have been willing? In the event, of course, when they were challenged by aggressor nations, they proved, despite many pledges, to be unwilling. But there is at least a possibility that America's participation in the League might have heartened the Western democracies when Hitler and Mussolini began to test their will. There is at least a possibility that if all the democracies had been united, history might have been different. The Senate, which in the previous century, during its golden age, had kept alive for 40 years, 40 vital years, the possibility of peace for the Union, in the 20th century had struck a great, perhaps mortal blow at the possibility of peace for the world. In the 19th century, the Senate had played a significant, for a considerable portion of that century, a dominant role in America's foreign policy. In the first 2 decades of the 20th century, it had played a much more minor role in foreign affairs. It had made a single significant decision, and that decision had been a tragedy. And in domestic affairs, the record was, if possible, worse. With the dawn of the new century, the public's demand for an end to trusts and to the high protective tariff that was the mother of trusts, the tariff that robbed farmers and gouged consumers, and that had now been in place for almost 50 years, the demand for legislation to ameliorate the injustices of the Industrial Revolution that had begun to rise during the Gilded Age only to be thwarted in part by the Senate, began to rise faster, fed by the books of Jacob Riis and Lincoln Steffens and Theodore Dreiser and 100 other authors, by the new mass circulation magazines, which in the very first years of the 20th century educated America about the manipulations of Standard Oil and stirred its conscience to the horrors of sweatshops and child labor. In 1900, almost 2 million boys and girls were working, often alongside their mothers, all the daylight hours, 7 days a week, in rooms in which there might not be a single window. And by the populist and Grange movements, which gave farmers insight into the power that railroads and banks had over their lives, and into their helplessness against them. These feelings now crested in a great wave of humanitarian concern, an outraged, impassioned demand for social justice that became known as the Progressive Movement. That wave swept over city halls. Long-entrenched boss rule was swept aside by reform mayors in 100 cities, It swept over state houses. Reformed governors pushed through child labor laws and laws increasing protection from and compensation for on-the-job injuries. And with McKinley's assassination, there was suddenly, in Theodore Roosevelt, a president who reformers felt was one of their own. Their moral leader, in fact. The very embodiment of the popular will, of the spirit of reform, of progressivism, was in the White House. At the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue were the Supreme Court, the House, and the Senate. All were far more conservative than the spirit of the age, but the Court could act only in areas in which it was asked to rule, and while the House was a force against progressivism during a relatively brief period in which Joseph Cannon reigned as Speaker, the rest of the time that still-growing body, it would reach 435 members in 1910, was in its customary disarray, a force against or for nothing. The Senate was not in disarray. As the Foreign Relations Committee had been its stronghold against the League, against progressivism, the stronghold was the Finance Committee, still dominated by Allison, Aldrich, John Spooner of Wisconsin, and Thomas Platt of New York. The Senate Four, or the Big Four, as they were known, still met in summer at Aldrich's great castle in Narragansett, near Newport. Four aging men in stiff high white collars and dark suits. Aldrich, being at home, might occasionally unbend to wear a blazer. Even on the hottest days, sitting on a colonnaded porch in rockers and wicker chairs, deciding Republican policy. A policy that was still based on an unshaken belief in laissez-faire and the protective tariff. And as the New York Times reported, the four bosses of the Senate can and do control that body. This means that these four men can block and defeat anything the President or the House may desire. Aware of this power, the new president was aware, too, that senators would play a key role in disposing of the presidential renomination he coveted. And while in certain areas he moved against the trusts with unprecedented vigor, ordering his attorney general to initiate suits to protect miners from the strike-breaking tactics of the big coal operators, and although he continually proclaimed the need for government supervision over business, the supervision turned out during his first term to be limited to executive actions he could take on his own authority without the need for legislation from Congress. When he ventured toward broader moves, he always took the Senate into account. His rhetoric was as dramatic as even the most passionate progressive could have hoped. But in August 1902, the Big Four, along with several other senatorial elders, including Mark Hanna, the man who made McKinley, traveled to Roosevelt's home on Long Island for an all-day conference. A month later, there was another conference, and this time it was the president who came to the senators, sailing across Long Island Sound to Narragansett, where the senators were waiting for him at Aldrich's castle. And thereafter, T.R.'s speeches on the tariff and the monetary system were first submitted to Aldrich for approval. On one occasion, the president wrote the senator that, "I want to be sure to get what I say on these two subjects along lines upon which all of us can agree." Dynamic in delivery, though the speeches continued to be, they were somewhat less so in content. Abrupt changes in the tariff would be dangerous, he said. Any changes that were made should be managed by experts, working primarily from the standpoint of business interests. Sound and wise words, Allison and Spooner said. In 1904, the American people's demand for social justice, a demand now in its fourth decade, carried Roosevelt to election in his own right. The current he rode was public opinion, Josephson says. In 1904 it ran more swiftly, stronger than ever in the direction of popular reform. Encouraged, the president turned to what he called the paramount issue, the regulation of railroads for which farmers had pleaded for 30 years, while for 30 years discriminatory freighting charges had kept rising. The country rallied behind T.R. when he called on Congress to give the Interstate Commerce Commission authority over rates and regulations. And the House, by a majority of 346-7, passed a strong bill. At first glance, prospects in the Senate seemed unprecedentedly favorable. Platt was dying, Allison and Spooner were in their last terms. 1905 marked the arrival in the Senate of a group of independent Republicans, such as Borah of Idaho, who took their cue from Wisconsin's little giant, the reformer Robert La Follette. Progressives felt their time had come. Dying though the old guard may have been, however, it wasn't surrendering. When Beveridge spoke for railroad regulation, Aldrich, his suave facade cracking for once, snarled at the young senator, "We'll get you for this." When the Follett, fresh from his triumphs in the provinces, rose in the Senate to give his maiden speech, a plea for regulation, one by one the Republican elders stood up at their desks and stalked out of the chamber. By the time the railroad bill finally emerged from the Senate, and then from a Senate House Conference Committee, the strong House measure had been drastically watered down. Theodore Roosevelt's subsequent victories in the progressive cause, protection of the nation's forests, for example, and regulation of the food and drug industries, were generally victories that did not require Senate concurrence. Or, after 1905, when Speaker Joseph Cannon solidified his control of the House, the concurrence of that body. Denouncing malefactors of great wealth, the President came out for federal income and inheritance taxes that would begin a leveling of wealth, for broader regulation of corporations, and for reforms in factory working conditions. The Senate's old guard, and the House's canon, decided that reform had gone far enough, and that was as far as reform went. Although as the champion of the American people, T.R. had campaigned for almost 8 years against economic injustice, his victories, at least his domestic victories, were generally achieved by the exercise of his executive authority. He had managed to broaden that authority, but only to the point at which it conflicted with legislative power. When he left office, there was still no federal child labor law, no effective federal workman's compensation law. The problems posed by trusts and tariffs had not been resolved, and the Senate was the principal reason. And when, in 1909, there was a new president, there was still the old guard, as was demonstrated in their first encounter. William Howard Taft had been advocating tariff reduction, a reduction desired by the overwhelming majority of the American people, since he was a young man. The Republican Party platform of 1908 had contained an unequivocal pledge for tariff revision, and Taft quickly summoned Congress into special session to pass a tariff bill drawn in good faith with the platform's promises. The House of Representatives passed one, a measure that would substantially reduce many duties, but its bill was then sent to the Senate Finance Committee. Allison, Platt, and Spooner were gone, but their places around the Green Bay's committee table were filled by other old guard stalwarts, and the committee's gavel was still in the hand of Nelson Aldrich. Hearings were held behind closed doors, and the bill that was reported out was no longer a bill for tariff reduction, but for tariff increases. Of 847 amendments on individual items, 600 raised existing rates. As a prairie fire of indignation spread across an outraged nation, editorials denounced Aldrich as dictator, despot, tyrant. But the Founding Fathers had armored the Senate against indignation, and Aldrich did not even attempt to conceal his contempt for the people. His only response was a sneer on the Senate floor. "Certainly the Republican platform had promised tariff revision," he said, "but where did we ever make the statement that we would revise the tariff downward?" Taft gave in, but 10 progressive Republicans, led by La Follette, decided to fight. Among them were some of the era's greatest orators, and the battle they made on the Senate floor day after day, all through a long, hot Washington summer, in a debate out of the Senate's long-gone golden age, a battle against not only a president of their own party, but against the mighty Aldrich as well, was the great topic of the hour. Reporters crowded the press gallery above the presiding officer's dais. Teletypes clattered with news. On the summer-baked streets of cities and towns all across America, men and women discussed the arguments made on the floor of America's Senate, among those 4 curved rows of mahogany and red leather. And all during that summer of 1909, public outrage against Aldrich and the old guard rose. But the Senate had been created to stand against public opinion. Aldrich's bill passed easily, and so did the Compromise Act that emerged from a stacked conference committee, an act that La Follette branded the consummation of privilege more reprehensible than had ever found a place in the statutes of the country. It was quickly signed into law by Taft. When Aldrich had first reported his bill out of committee, and the prairie fire had been raging against it, the senator had predicted calmly that the bill would pass substantially as he had written it. The prediction had proven correct. During the remaining years of Taft's presidency, there would be a few victories for reformers to celebrate, but only a few. By March 1910, Cannon had been ousted as Speaker, and in the elections that November, public indignation removed the GOP from control of the House. But in the Senate, that indignation echoed only faintly, and when, in 1911, Aldrich retired, the old guard's ranks simply closed around the gap as solidly as ever. And Taft continued to compromise with, more accurately to surrender to, the Senate's power. At the end of the Taft administration in 1913, as at the end of the Roosevelt administration in 1909, a supposedly representative republic had not come to grips with concentrated economic power, or with the impact of that power on the human condition. A tide of concern about the impact of industrial concentration on America had begun rising during the Gilded Age, had begun rising soon after the end of the Civil War in 1865, in fact. At first, the tide had risen slowly, but by the 1880s and 90s, it was rising fast. But all through the Gilded Age, the Senate had stood against the tide. At the turn of the century, with the onset of the Progressive Era, the tide became a wave, a great wave of conscience, of anger over injustice, of demand for a cleansing of government and for a mobilization of government to meet the needs of its people. The wave of progressivism and reform washed across America, through state houses and city halls, even through the White House. When the wave crashed against the Senate, it broke on the Senate, the waters falling away from it as they had been falling away for half a century. The Senate stood as it had been standing for so long, a mighty dam standing athwart and stemming the tides of social justice. Chapter 2. Great Things Are Underway. In 1913, Woodrow Wilson, who had been swept into the White House by the wave, was inaugurated, and the gates of the dam swung open at last. In his inaugural address, Wilson said that, "We have not hitherto stopped thoughtfully enough to count the human cost of our industrial achievements. The great government we loved has too often been made use of for private and selfish purposes, and those who used it had forgotten the people." And he knew the cure: presidential leadership. The president, who had the people behind him, must, to meet conditions that menace our civilization, formulate a comprehensive legislative program and push it through to passage. For a century, ever since Thomas Jefferson, to emphasize the separation between executive and legislative branches, had ended the practice, no president had appeared in person before Congress. But in April 1913, Wilson did so, announcing to a joint session the first bill he wanted Congress to take up, a new tariff reduction measure. The revenue lost was to be made up by instituting a graduated income tax. For the first time in a quarter of a century, there were Democratic majorities in both houses of Congress, and many of the new Democrats in the Senate shared Wilson's philosophy and were willing, at least during the first year of his administration, to accept his direction, as was the leader they selected, John Worth Kern of Indiana, who had been in the Senate only 2 years. The Republican ranks had been broken at last, by death and retirement and new additions to La Follette's insurgent Republican bloc. And Wilson kept attacking. The day after his address, he was in the Capitol again, meeting privately with Democratic leaders. A tariff reduction bill passed the House, but the House had passed such bills before, and always the reductions had become increases in the Senate, or had died there. And reformers who had cursed the protective tariff for decades had come to believe that tariff reform would always die in the Senate. But this time, Wilson went to the people with a dramatic appeal against the lobbyists' power, saying that only public opinion can check and destroy it. And the Senate bill, passed 44-37, contained rates even lower than those the House had approved, as well as the momentous income tax that marked the beginning of the democratization of the federal financial structure. "Think of it, a tariff reduction downwards after all," wrote Agriculture Secretary David Houston. "Lower in the Senate than in the House. A progressive income tax. I did not much think we should live to see these things." Even while Congress was still debating the tariff bill, Wilson had summoned it into a second joint session, at which he called for the creation of a system of regional banks controlled by a Federal Reserve Board. Its 7 members would be appointed by the President with the advice and consent of the Senate. That would end Wall Street's control of money and credit. His private sessions on Capitol Hill were also continuing. Sitting in the ornate president's room just off the Senate chamber, he conferred with and brought the powers of the presidency to bear upon individual senators. He installed a private telephone line between the White House and the Capitol. So successful were Wilson's methods that not a single Democratic senator voted against the Federal Reserve Act. And as soon as it passed, Wilson was back, again appearing before Congress to ask for laws, the Federal Trade Commission Act and the Clayton Antitrust Act, to investigate and police trusts and monopolies, and to protect organized labor from injunctions. And these passed, too. The president held Congress in session for a year and a half, the longest session in history, and during it transformed the balance of power between executive and legislature in America's government, pushing through Congress social laws that progressives had all but given up hope of seeing passed in their lifetime. The Senate's golden age had begun in 1819, and although those days of Senate glory had lasted only about 40 years, the days of Senate power had lasted another 50 and more. At the end of the 19th century, the Senate had still been the Senate supreme. And while, during the Theodore Roosevelt and Taft presidencies at the beginning of the 20th century, senatorial power had diminished in foreign affairs, it had remained intact, if anything, it had increased, in domestic affairs. For better and for worse, the institution had stood firm against both executive and popular tyranny for almost a century. The year 1913, a year which also saw the ratification of the 17th Amendment, which mandated the popular election of senators that reformers had long believed would make the Senate more responsive to the will of the people, marked the first substantial break in that power. And then the gates of the dam swung shut again. By the summer of 1914, in fact, the first signs of reaction were already perceptible. And that was the year of the Guns of August, and thereafter Woodrow Wilson's energies were increasingly focused on international affairs. And over his relationship with the Senate there crept, year by year, deeper and deeper shadows. The Tariff Reduction Bill was the signpost of the beginning of Wilson's relationship with the Senate. The signpost at the end was the Treaty of Versailles. And after Wilson came the return to normalcy. Most of the men puffing the big cigars in the legendary smoke-filled room at the 1920 Republican Convention were senators. Someone remarked that the room looked like a Senate in miniature, with Henry Cabot Lodge biting off brief comments while the others ruffled through possible presidential candidates like a deck of soiled cards. And, determined to reassert the Senate's authority, they wanted a pliable president who, in Lodge's job description, will not try to be an autocrat, but will do his best to carry on the government in the old and accepted constitutional ways. Who better than one of their own to fill this role? And the old guard's Warren G. Harding was elevated directly from his Senate desk to the White House. In his ears, his colleague's admonition to sign whatever bills the Senate sent him and not send bills for the Senate to pass. Under Harding and Coolidge and Hoover, this normalcy was to last for almost a decade. A decade during which, slowly but steadily, the tariff began to rise again and federal spending to fall. Federal regulations on business were relaxed, and the tax burden was shifted from the rich to the middle class and the poor. The 20s were, of course, a decade in which a prosperous America was content to rely on big business rather than government for leadership, and little of that commodity came from the White House or from either of the two chambers on Capitol Hill. The Senate's philosophy was a philosophy that favored free enterprise over social reform. Tighter Republican control of the House enabled it to rise to equality with the Senate, but that only meant that the two bodies, squabbling continually over details, spent the decade bouncing bills back and forth. And when, on Black Friday, 1929, normalcy abruptly ended, the Senate had little to contribute to solving the crisis. While it had once been the deliberative body the framers had envisioned, one among whose desks fundamental policies had been debated in debates that educated a nation, that educative function had atrophied during decades of making decisions behind closed doors. Once it had been a place of leaders, men who conceived daring solutions to daunting problems, and then persuaded public and colleagues to support those solutions. Decades of the seniority rule had conferred influence in the Senate, not on men who broke new ground, but on men who were careful not to. so that when in 1929 crisis came, and with the last of those passive presidents still in office, leadership was so desperately needed, the Senate had as little to offer as the House. The President and the leadership of Congress, that leadership that was still staunchly conservative in both houses, clung to their belief that the best cure for the business crisis was business as usual. Business as usual meant raising the tariff, and during the months following the crash, that was the priority on Capitol Hill. The bill drawn by ardent protectionists Senator Reed Smoot of Utah and Congressman Willis C. Hawley of Oregon raised duties to prohibitive levels. Senator La Follette called the bill the product of a series of deals conceived in secret but executed in public with a brazen effrontery that is without parallels in the annals of the Senate, a remark that revealed his ignorance of Senate annals. When in June 1930 President Hoover signed the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, using six solid gold pens, one historian wrote that Nelson Aldrich's ghost no doubt smiled down in approval. National concern over the deepening depression gave the Democrats control of the House of Representatives in 1930 for the first time since 1919, and while the GOP clung to a 48-47 plurality in the Senate, the margin was meaningless, since La Follette's insurgent Republicans were not inclined to follow President Hoover's policies. And when Congress convened in December 1931, the month in which 23-year-old Lyndon Johnson arrived in Washington as secretary to one of the newly elected Democratic congressmen, it did so in the midst of a nationwide demand for action. The mail sacks that the staffs of senators and representatives opened each morning were filled with desperation now, as a nation's people begged their government for help. But little help came from the White House. President Hoover's solution to the Depression was still largely to maintain that it was over, and that proposals for direct federal aid for relief or for increased spending on public works were as unnecessary as debt relief for farmers. Although thousands of American families were losing their farms, relief funds had run out for states and municipalities, and every day the soup kitchen lines grew longer. And little help came from Capitol Hill. The House was even more confused and disorganized than usual. A columnist called it the Monkey House, and his sentiment was echoed by some of the congressmen themselves. Declared John McDuffie of Alabama, "Representative government is dead." In the other wing of the Capitol, some senators, the younger La Follette, New York's Robert F. Wagner, George W. Norris of Nebraska, Hugo Black of Alabama, sought to rise to the crisis with proposals for a federal public works program, a federal system of unemployment insurance, direct federal relief. But there was little agreement among these senators and little leadership. Many senators seemed to doubt whether Congress could do anything in the crisis. Senator Thomas Gore of Oklahoma was probably expressing the general sentiment when he said dourly that you could no more relieve the depression by legislation than you can pass a resolution to prevent disease. When, after months of wrangling over details, a relief and public works bill finally passed Congress, Hoover vetoed it, and there was never a realistic chance that the Senate would override the veto. But that was the high point of congressional action to fight the Depression. In the midst of one of the nation's gravest crises, Congress failed to meet for 9 months. Adjourning in March 1931, it did not reconvene until January 1932. By the time it reconvened, there were between 15 million and 17 million unemployed men in America, many of whom represented an entire family in want. Reminders of the nation's desperation were all over Washington. Bonus marchers, 25,000 penniless World War veterans, paraded up Pennsylvania Avenue in May and then pitched tents in parks so that Washington, D.C. resembled the besieged capital of an obscure European state. But for Congress, 1932 was 7 months of wrangling and delay, and the measures it passed were so inadequate as to be all but meaningless. Under its relief bill, passed after months of haggling, the average stipend for a family of four was 50 cents per day. When vital tax and tariff reforms were introduced, special interest groups and states traded tariff proposals back and forth until, in May, one senator shouted, "Have we gone mad? Have we no idea that if we carry this period of unrest from 1 week to another, a panic will break loose, which all the tariffs under heaven will not stem? Yet we sit here to take care of some little interest in this state or that. My state, my state. My God, let's hear my country. What good is your state if your country sinks into the quagmire of ruin? For months, Forum magazine said, the country has been looking on with something like anguish at the spectacle of the inability of the national legislature for dealing with the crucial problem of national finance. Congress adjourned in July 1932. By the time it reconvened in December, 158 of its members had been defeated in the election, as had President Hoover. But the congressmen and Hoover were still going to be in office until March. The winter ahead was a winter of despair. When the lame duck Congress convened, crowded around the Capitol steps were more than 2,500 men, women, and children, chanting, "Feed the hungry! Tax the rich!" Heavily armed police herded the hunger marchers into a detention camp on New York Avenue, where, denied food or water, they spent a freezing night sleeping on the pavement, taunted by their guards. Thereafter, when Congress was in session, a double line of rifle-carrying police blocked the Capitol steps. And behind these bodyguards, Congress spent yet more months posturing and procrastinating, angrily deadlocking over conflicting relief bills, while arguing interminably over whether to legalize beer. As for the President Reject, as time called him, he spent those months trying to commit his successor to a continuation of his discredited policies. As, that winter, farmers began to march in what might have been the prelude to revolution, as the nation's great banks began to close, Washington still did nothing substantive. A great nation was collapsing, and its government, of which the Senate had once been a pillar, seemed paralyzed, utterly unable to prevent the collapse. Senators came to the chamber wearing money belts as the safest place to keep their cash. The institution which had once excited the admiration of great statesmen now aroused only contempt. Then, at his inauguration on March 4, 1933, the new president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, declaring that this nation asks for action and action now, summoned Congress into special session. If there was a single moment in America's history in which the slow slide of power, now in its fourth decade, from Capitol Hill to the White House, suddenly became an avalanche, so that for decades thereafter governmental initiative came overwhelmingly from the executive branch, with the legislature only reacting to that initiative, it was that session. The session that lasted 100 days, and was so significant a landmark in the nation's history that it became enshrined as the 100 days, the session in which a president proposed and proposed and proposed again, in which he proposed the most far-reaching of measures, a session in which Congress scampered in panic to approve those proposals as fast as it could. Should Congress fail to provide immediate action, the second Roosevelt said, I shall not evade the clear course of duty that will then confront me. I shall ask the Congress for the one remaining instrument to meet the crisis, broad executive power to wage war against the emergency. When Congress convened on March 9th, he had waiting for it an Emergency Banking Relief Act that included sweeping presidential authority over the Federal Reserve System. The bill had not yet been printed, only one typed copy was available, and it was read to the House, which limited debate to 40 minutes. Even before that time expired, representatives were shouting, "Vote! Vote!" and the vote was by a unanimous shout. The Senate was in a similar rush. When Huey Long of Louisiana proposed an amendment, he was shouted down, and the bill, a bill few senators had even seen, was passed 73-7.
End of Disc 3.